You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. I'm your host today, David Gilmore, with Ted McMahon of Seattle, though not Northwesterner, except since 1970s, from the East Coast. He's been a pediatrician most of his working life in Seattle, in Ballard, and yet he's also become a poet, and he's also a river rafter. But in poetry, he has been a co-editor of Floating Bridge Press, and in rafting and boating, he takes journeys with tours of people, I imagine, right?
Yes.
Down the Colorado River, the Grand Canyon. So we're going to go east and west and also to the southwest a little bit in Ted's verse. And he has a very fine little chapbook called The Uses of Imperfection, from which you will read some, but he's also collected many new works over the last decade or so and is getting ready for another publication, seeking publication for another collection. Welcome to Sound Poetry, Ted. Happy to have you here.
Thank you very much, David. Nice to be here.
Your poetry is not always very long. It fits within the page. It looks somewhat conventional and traditional since there's no zigzagging lines or little thin word catalogs, but at the same time, you put your ideas into very matter of fact images. There is a hardness to those images, and so you wanted to begin today with grapefruit. Which, before we learn any more about you, let's wake the readers up with your grapefruit poem.
Okay, David. Grapefruit has to do with my grandfather, my mother's father. My grandfather got up early to section grapefruit. I know because I got up quietly to watch. He was tall. His hairless shins stuck out below his bathrobe, down to leather slippers. The house was quiet, sun just up, ticking of the grandfather clock, tall in the corner. The grapefruit were always sectioned just so, nestled in clear, nubbled bowls used for nothing else, with half a maraschino centered, bleeding slowly into soft, pale triangles of fruit. It was special grapefruit, Indian River, not to be had back home. Doves cooed outside, and the last night breeze rustled the palms against the eaves. He turned to see me, pale light flashing off his glasses, and smiled. I remember as I work my knife along the membrane separating sections. It's dawn. The doves and palms are far away. I don't use cherries anymore. The clock is digital, and no one is watching.
Mouth-watering. I think when grapefruit is mentioned and then cutting into it, there is something very succulent. It loosens the saliva in a reader's mind, bringing it to mind. And yet this is a comparison. It's a memory from the past. Whereabouts was your grandfather and yourself in this one?
My grandfather and my grandmother retired to Florida, to Naples, Florida, back in the 50s. And we visited them for the first time when I was about 8. My first airplane ride, 1954. It was a 4-engine Constellation, beautiful airplane. And we visited them from time to time for several years until he passed away.
So you say not to be had back home. You're implying where you came from.
We were at that time in Massachusetts. And for a time we were in Cincinnati, but we would visit, we would drive down there.
So you were born in Massachusetts near Boston?
That's correct, yes.
Did you do most of your schooling there?
I did through junior high school. I spent my high school mostly in Cincinnati and then came back to Massachusetts. I went to college in Western Massachusetts, yes.
So did you get your poetry interests enlivened through school in Boston?
You know, I don't believe so, David. I've always loved reading, so I've read lots of different kinds of things. And I fancied myself that I wanted to be a writer. I started off with essays. And the more I read my essays, the more wordy they seemed. And I kept cutting them down shorter and shorter until they fit on a page. And I thought, well, goodness, this looks like poetry. Maybe I should take some classes. So I did when I was about 40.
Oh, so you came to it a little bit later in life.
That's right.
And so did you enjoy poetry readings in Seattle?
Yes. I was lucky. I fell in with a group of poets. We met every 2 or 3 weeks to read our work. It was very helpful to run things by other people.
Good. So you're quite familiar with the Northwest poet scene. And so the uses of imperfection. This is the title of your collection. I think that one has to be certainly one that we read for, it's the opening poem. And imperfection is interesting, I think, in terms of art. So we'll perhaps talk a little bit about that, but read your wonderful Rodin poem.
Certainly. The uses of imperfection. The floor is littered with shards. The tables filled with assemblage, still shrouded in wet burlap, stiff with cold. Rodin, at 24, stalks the atelier, huge hands fisted, locomotive clouds of breath. He's had it up to here with nymphs, smooth-limbed cherubs, the mind-numbing symmetries of the salon. He spies the janitor, shambling like a bear with a broom, punch-drunk, prematurely gray. Peremptorily he cries, "Bibi, come here." For that week, Bibi sits hunched, the master molds. The mass of clay becomes the shaggy head of Bibi, with its broken nose.
There's a story about this, of course, and you have a very interesting green-colored, greenish-gray image on the front of the bust, the profile of Bibi, done by Rodin with his broken nose, his boxer's nose, right?
Yes.
Tell a little bit about that. I think that's interesting that you chose a subject like that.
Well, when I was putting the idea of a book together, I wasn't quite sure what to call it. A lot of it has to do with perfectionism, having to do with being a physician. But we visited the Rodin Museum in Paris, and I saw this particular piece of statuary, and I thought, it's about imperfection, and you can turn something that is imperfect into something that's really worthwhile to look at and spend time with.
So you didn't take the picture. You found this photograph, did you?
Actually, we looked at the museum. They allowed us to look at their photo collection. We didn't really find anything suitable. So my wife, who's a photographer, went ahead and took the cover photo.
Ah, so you have collaboration in this then.
Yes.
Artistic collaboration too. interesting that this big bulky boxer is named Bibi. Kind of a baby name in some respects for somebody that's so large and, ill-formed at this point in his life after a life of boxing.
Yes.
Punch drunk and prematurely gray. But in art, do you favor a certain amount of imperfection?
I do. I don't like things that are totally symmetrical. They seem to me boring. I think I remember that the Navajo people, when they weave rugs, they always leave a little piece of it unfinished or not quite perfect, because to try and make it perfect would be presumptuous, I think, is the way they look at it.
That's right. That's true. I've noticed that in a lot of their patterns of their rugs and paintings too. They do the same thing in painting. But imperfection. My wife was an artist in school, and she said she never liked the svelte models or the muscular man that was sort of the perfect anatomical friend. She loved the roly-poly people, the one where maybe there was one leg a little shorter than the other, a hip higher. And she said the face, a little puffy and jowly, maybe would have been good too. Artists tend to like something that's got an unusual shape that the eye perhaps needs to look very carefully at to capture it, rather than imagine that this is how it should be. Mm-hmm. And that then is the search for imperfections. Yeah. Very good. The floor littered in shards. The table was filled, but Rodin had it up to here with nymphs. That's a very good idea to in Rodin's, certainly in Rodin's world, right? He had quite a few nymphs himself.
He did.
Quite the rake. We go on the water here, right?
We certainly can.
Doldrums is the one that you chose, I think, that exemplifies your concern with boating. And
Doldrums has to do with boating, sailboating in a way, but it also has to do with the experience of depression. We have a fair bit of that in my family. I was trying to put the two things together. Doldrums. There were warnings, I suppose. Coated flags hung from distant spars. Rounding the headland in light air, you disappeared within a gray glove of fog. Anchored there, becalmed, loath to go ashore or chart a course, beyond that bay, you wait. Watch the kelp, sargasso-bound, drift tangled underneath the surface sheen. Fathomless white air, muffled bird sounds, dull clank of halyard against the idled mast. Fogbound, square-rigged clippers waited safely for the trades. Today, who guarantees that black cliff-sided freighter, dead reckoning, slicing silent in the mist, knows where you are? Triangulated, you rely on silver satellites, pasted like tiny pills against the freezing dark.
Now that you mentioned the depression, the kelp and sargasso bound waters is a hint of ancient mariner in some respects there, the doldrums of that work.
Yes.
And the halyard against an idled mast. Yeah, you're stuck. You're in a situation of stasis in the doldrums. Yeah, that's interesting that you brought that up. I don't know how many, we don't have a lot of time to contemplate a poem in listening to it read, although that's certainly the performance that's best expected by a lot of people who like poetry. But you often don't have a chance to ruminate on some of the deeper shades of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's very interesting. That did all of a sudden give me another perspective on it. Dead reckoning is an interesting mm-hmm. word there, almost an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. Reckoning being something that's actually going on, and it's dead reckoning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very good. And we go to the final one in your, which also brings up another interest of yours, I think, in the Eastern philosophies, perhaps, the Eastern religious thought, Dakota Bodhisattva.
Bodhisattva. My wife is from North Dakota, and we visit probably every year for the last 40 years. It's a beautiful country. It takes some getting used to. I'm also very interested in Buddhist thought, and somehow the two go together, the place and that kind of thinking. Dakota Bodhisattva. A dirt road stretches silent to each cardinal point. Four red octagons. Nothing but the rattle of wind through wheat and nodding heads of sunflowers, big as plates, a bowl of blue above. No other sign, no arrow. Was I expected elsewhere, sleeves rolled up, elbow deep in the clangor of cities? I remember certain kindnesses received, given, and wonder if my sum exceeds the mean, or if, as at the county fair, a single hammer stroke decides my fate. How many turns beneath the tent to grasp the ring? Still no traffic. I kill the engine. I'll settle to have sparked a single flash of joy, to have erased a single line of sorrow.
Just as in the boat being stalled in a fog, here you're at a central point with roads going according to the cardinal points, stop signs, very quiet. Things are quieting down in this, although there is a good bit of fertility in the beginning of it with the fields of wheat and nodding heads of sunflower and so on. But as it goes on, there is a kill the engine, settle to have sparked a single flash of joy, to have erased a single line of sorrow. It definitely goes through a transformation. I think it goes to a still point. Is that what you were aiming for in this one, to find this kind of quiet stillness that is not interrupted?
Indeed. The place lends itself to meditation. That's what I was doing at that point.
Yes, sparking a single flash of joy. That's a very, very nice phrase, yes. I think we've had a look at a few aspects of your perspectives on poetry with those four. And now we're going to some more contemporary works that you've been working on. These are from a work to come called Visitations. And you start in a dream.
Yes, this is the lead poem. Many of these came out of dream work, which I'd been doing for a while, this one particularly. In the dream, I cut my wrist. It opened like a mouth along a keloid scar. No blood, but deep fascia was involved, requiring double layer closure. It was like a page from Grey's Anatomy. I couldn't feel it. I'd have sutured it myself, except I never had the knack for one-hand knots. Then I thought of poetry, of how the line should flow, crimson with feeling. The wound blinked closed then, like an eye. I got up and wrote that down.
Well, lucky you that you could remember a dream to work on it as a poem. But it is dreamlike. And Kafka, in his works, often has wounds that show up, which always seem to me like some sort of horrific dream or nightmare image. And this one brought Kafka to mind, the opening and the closing of it, like an eye. Very nice twist in the way of dreams. And the next one you have chosen is for your grandfather. Is this the same grandfather of the Great Poop Sections?
Actually, this is the other grandfather. This is my father's father, who I was finally able to track down where he was born, because he had misled people about his actual birthday for various reasons. He was born in Dublin, and this poem was written during a visit to Ireland. And it's a place where, in Ireland, you have a sense that people who are no longer with you, have passed away, are actually closer than they might seem. So this is called For My Grandfather. The wind flows cloud across the burren, flows across and scours exposed bones of the world, while the morning bells fade in the distance above the high crosses. On a morning much like this one in the wind-chopped bay, a steamer headed west out of Galway City, a boy of 15 on deck, alone. A boy in a poorhouse coat, ill-fitting hat, one blue star for starboard, tattooed between thumb and finger of his right hand, a green anchor for port on his left. Steady in his gaze, gray curtains of cloud, gray stone, and the gray-green sea melt together, form his last look at this land.
So, at what age did he depart? 15 on deck?
He was 15, yes.
Did he ever go back to Ireland?
I don't believe he did, no. One of his sisters stayed in Ireland. She used to run a bar in Dundalk, which is north of Dublin. Mm-hmm. And her name was Mary. We almost got to visit her, but when I went to the pub, the bartender said, no, you can't visit with Mary because she's taking her nap. So we had to leave.
Gosh. Yes, too important for her to have a nap to meet long-lost relatives, huh?
Yeah.
I know, that's strange about the hospitality or lack of hospitality sometimes when you go expecting to see someone when you knock on a door. Mm-hmm. And the person comes to the door and says, oh, gosh, I haven't seen you in 20 years. But you know, tonight's my bingo night. And I'm sorry, I can't let you in. I've got to be out of here and catch the bus. Things like that, where we experienced. But anyway, you're in here. It's so sad when you leave a place that you were born in and lived in and knew well, that though we think of Ireland as green pastures, a lot of greenery, here it's grey curtains of cloud, grey stone, grey green sea melting together. And the last look at the land. It's a sort of sad imagery with the greyness in it, because the grey really puts things in a shroud of some sort. You went, and did you see it as a green land when you went there?
Well, yes, much of it is green. We were in the west, in County Clare, which is where this is taking place. The Burren is about 1,000-foot limestone monolith right near the water in County Clare. And there's plenty of green, but there's also plenty of gray, lots of stone.
Yes. I think a boy going by himself to have the star and the anchor to give an idea of the lie of the land, so to speak, on water. That is a very nice touch. The star and the anchor. Stars never seem quite anchored, but you've got those both together. Very, very interesting. You went to Galway then?
Yes.
Yeah. And that is the bay beyond which the Aran Islands stick out, right? They're
That's
out
correct.
There somewhere. Dun Angus is a name. What is the name of?
Dun Angus it's a fort. It's a prehistoric fort that's right on the western tip of that Aran Island. And they say when you go out there and you look west, the only thing out there is Boston.
All right. So, it does look over that way.
Yes. We took a ferry boat from Doolin, and my grandfather does figure in this one as well. Dun Angus. I was scared, but leapt the 3-foot gap between the bobbing tender and the Doolin ferry. Heavy seas all the way to Inishmore, the farthest Aran Island. Uphill grades on bulky rented bikes. Not one of our 3 dozen knew the way. Sheer drops down limestone cliffs and gnashing foam-flecked green below. Then steep return, helmetless down unmarked one lanes, to find a washed-out bridge. The climb, bike-shouldered up through rough potato fields, my grandfather might have worked, to the proper road, late. Afraid to miss the final ferry, I spun downhill, alone, I thought, then received his final gift, the weight of 50 years of worry lifted.
A biking tour that you went on with a group of people, is it?
Yes. I was a guest. There were 30 of us.
And you went on to the islands?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how far around are the islands? They look very tiny.
I think it's maybe 2 miles across. Mm-hmm. Quite small.
In your poetry, I don't know if people have listened carefully enough, but there's a great deal of music with, for example, I was afraid, 3-foot gap, dueling ferry, and so on. You use a great deal of consonants and assonants to make the music of your poetry, as well as the meter, of course. There's a metrical form there, but you don't choose rhyme very much, perhaps at least not in the way that most people would notice rhyme at the end of the verse, right?
Right. I like to hide it inside.
Yes. Actually, I have begun to notice how that did come through. Afraid to miss the final ferry home, I spun downhill alone, I thought. There is a sort of near rhyme. But it's got the same feel of the music of it. And at the end, again, you return to the Fs of the first verse, fears of 50 years. Fears of 50 years were lifted, which is a pretty close rhyme.
So I think my favorite form is a sonnet, actually. A lot mm-hmm. of these are 14 lines long, but they're not strictly in the sonnet form, but it has a feel that way.
Okay, so it's really a semblance, but not any adherence to the strict form that that sonnet asks from the Shakespearean type of work. Yeah,
yes,
yeah, it's all right. I think poets should be able to try different forms and fail at them. And find that even that failure is close to what that form might have expressed. You know, it has some elegy in it, elegiac forms, if it's got an elegiac meter or what have you. But it's interesting how we do make different kinds of shapes to our poems in times today. Mm-hmm. And you don't play too many games. Your verses are very, very much in the same pattern and sometimes a similar meter throughout.
Mm-hmm.
The one on Ash Wednesday, where we go down to Mexico,
mm-hmm.
that one, for example.
This was a trip to Oaxaca with some friends. My first trip to Mexico, actually. And it was Ash Wednesday. It was in the spring. In the villages of central Mexico, the poor make belts of braided soft drink tabs. Zucchini soup contains the stems and flowers, as well as fruit. In Mexico, nothing is wasted. So the darkest of their recipes for mole calls for stale tortillas and the seeds of ancho chilies burned to ash and folded in. As if to guarantee the taste of dust and ashes always in one's mouth. As if one needed, in Mexico, yet another reminder of the presence of Los Muertos.
Was that long ago that you were there?
2004.
And in those days, not even then, I don't think then there was quite the gangsterism that there is now that's grown over the last two decades. But I think Mexico's always been a bit scary.
We found there was a lot of armed teenagers at checkpoints having to do with the drug trade, I think. But our friends spoke good Spanish, so we didn't get too worried about it.
Chilies burned to ash. Taste of dust and ashes in one's mouth. Very appropriate for the poem of an Ash Wednesday experience. Thank you so much, Ted. It was a real pleasure doing this with you. And please send me some more of your poems when you can. I'd like to see some more of the variations.
Thank you, David. It's really been a pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity.
This is Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, for Radio Tacoma with Ted McMahon of Seattle.